Welcome, welcome to episode 38 of Across the Aisle. We've begun to journey through season 4. Get a drink, take a seat, smile and wave across the room at my inspiration and tutor, Philip Teal.
Good evening, Carla.
Hello. I abruptly announced at the end of season 3 that I was beginning to become bored with the styles of shows we'd become accustomed to covering. Bored, perhaps, is not the right word, but I was thirsting for perhaps a little shake-up, some difference. Different crowds, different content, perhaps surprisingly men in the lead role, but also different venues and different forms of performance. Well, as you know, the first episode of season 4 really took us to places we haven't been on the show, metaphorically, of course, and physically, for me, in the work of Carrion by Justin Shoulder. And so this month, again, we have been looking outside of the box, into the neo-futuristic staging of William Tell by the Victorian Opera, and long neglected on the show avant-garde darlings of Melbourne Theatre MKA with their impossibly titled, a public reading of an unproduced screenplay about the death of Walt Disney, staged through the Southside Festival Provocare. So much amazing, fresh content for us to masticate, Phil. Please pass the apple for William Tell.
Yes. If I could make a convincing apple biting sound, I would, Carla. And I do have to start this review of William Tell by Victorian Opera with relishing the opera shooting moment from the version of the show that we saw when the apple exploded on the person's head. Best stage fail ever.
I thought we were going to talk about this more into the
show. Okay, we'll return to the exploding apple.
Oh my God.
So brilliant in every way. Victorian Opera, I almost said Opera Australia, but of course this is our darling local opera company, accompanied by Orchestra Victoria at the surprising venue of the Palais Theatre at St Kilda, right opposite Luna Park on a freezing night. William Tell's famous but rarely performed opera from his French period got an airing, the first time in many decades. And Richard Mills, the artistic director and conductor, is clearly very excited about it. He writes in the program that this opera, William Tell, is a challenge for any company. The principal roles are extremely demanding vocally, and the orchestra itself almost becomes a character in the opera in its own right. The original version, he writes, was written for the Paris Opera, and it was Rossini's last, even though he lived for many years. Now, every good perfumed French opera needs an update. That is the sort of going wisdom. And director Rodula Gaetanou absolutely relishes the opportunity to update this story for a kind of Trump-era, revolutionary, wish fulfillment period. And despite some elements in the script being unavoidably romantic with Swiss-like scenery and avalanches and lakes, providing lots of the poetry of the libretto, what we saw on stage here looked a little bit like what you might see in a contemporary protest event in the United States. Certainly the antagonists were futuristic and quite abstract in the way that they represented power almost robotically. And the humanity of the people who rose up was really emphasized as well. This was sort of people versus a machine. And that came across really powerfully. But for me, the whole experience was so gorgeously specific, site-specific. That theater is not a place that I've experienced very often. And it had a kind of dustiness that suited this return to 19th century lavish opera. Victorian State Opera is very proud of the big cast and the international group that it gathered for this production, and was making lots of proud claims about how this is more than it's ever done before. And I'm so interested to hear, Carla, from you, because I know that your exposure to opera is not as much as mine has been. Or tell me your story of opera going.
I did have a couple of 2 years back to back.
Oh, cool.
Subscription to the opera.
Oh, love it.
Back before I was 30 and one could afford those things. I really just went as an educational exercise. And, you know, I think I kind of got it. I understood enough of what I liked and what I didn't like, but I haven't really been back that much. I mean, the price is, you know, completely out of my grasp. So I did want to go see Carmen, but I'd never got it together enough to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's really my history.
Mm.
So I do have limited to probably more exposure to it than the layman or most of the people who listen to the show.
Mm.
You want to hear my opinions about the show? Okay, so probably the big thing that I want to get out of the way first is that I didn't love the music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of like, you know, an opera is sort of third music.
Yeah. It's a big part of it.
Music, singing, costumes, set design. So I found the music, like, and I just don't know whether it was the actual production. I'd be interested to hear your opinion, because the production itself was so all encasing and so ambitious. And both of these shows, actually, tonight we're going to talk about, are both very ambitious shows. Besides that, I mean, I didn't love the music in the way that it did kind of fade into the background for me for a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't really remarkable. But then again, I think, is that because, you know, you kind of get programmed into your opera's greatest hits, and every time you go and see one of the sort of more main stage operas, there's one or two things in there that you're like, oh, I know, I recognize this. I have that point of recognition.
Well, and the point of recognition here is at the end of the overture, and then it's done.
Yes.
So before we hear any singing, we've had our little gallop.
Yes, we've had everything.
Indeed.
The music kind of, I mean, obviously the musicians were amazing, but yeah, the music didn't really kind of do much for me. It just kind of felt like they were just singing the script.
Mm-hmm.
So that's out of the way. I loved this, however. What a thrilling, amazing experience. First of all, do you have to be super hot to get into Victorian opera? Because everybody on the stage.
Oh, okay, yes.
Everybody in the cast was crazy hot.
Mm-hmm. Armando Noguera and Carlos E. Barthenas.
I've got hipster dilfs here.
Oh, yes.
One of my notes, particularly William Tell, was the hipster dilf to end all hipster dilfs.
Mm-hmm.
And I also loved, I try not to read about things, but for things like the ballet and the opera, I do try to read the little handout that they give you before, just to kind of orient myself. And the first and only paragraph I read about this before the curtain went up was place. Occupied Switzerland in a dystopian future. The invaders are technologically superior force intent on the destruction of a simple and wholesome community, life in harmony with the rhythms of nature. I was like, yes.
Yes.
This neo-futuristic reimagining of this opera. I am in for whatever these people are going to bring.
Yeah. I mean, the word futurism and the word Switzerland in the same sentence.
And
it's
robots.
Just delicious.
Robotic.
Do you know my favourite element of this production was actually the man who sang Hi. So this is the character Arnold Melchthal, Carlos E. Barthenas. He has a famously high tenor role, and you hear it from the opening few phrases. It's a really difficult to squeeze out sort of role, which is apparently one of the reasons this is produced so rarely. And he was such an intriguing character in the script. You know, his love for this upper class woman from the royal family, Mathilde, who was played to diva-ish perfection by Gisela Still.
Mm, which we have to talk about as well.
You mean the fact that people weren't responding?
Yes.
Yeah, we sort of nudged each other a little bit. There was all of these rousing applause for the communist crowd scenes and the dilfs doing their, you know, bromance. And she seemed unable to rouse the same kind of reaction.
Any reaction. So anytime a male, I don't know the words properly, like they're tenors,
yeah,
aren't they?
Well, one of them is.
Anytime they would have a solo, they'd be like, bravo,
yeah,
and like people standing and applauding. And every time she would have a solo, I don't know the proper words for this stuff. Silence.
Yeah.
Fucking so weird. Crickets.
Especially since I reckon that this was written for a diva, a star of the Paris stage. I don't know the history, but it was framed in such a way that you absolutely needed to love this woman, this royal woman. She was such an idol and an icon, and I was there for her. But for some reason, that energy wasn't there on the night in the audience that we were in.
I call sexism. I'm sorry. I'm going to be very blunt.
Well, speaking of sexism, I want to say something about the note in the program from Richard Mills, sort of boasting about how this is a condensed version of the original epic 5-hour unperformable version that only a true Parisian, a sort of powdered Parisian, could understand. I was actually sad when I read the note where he described, you know, those crazy Frenchies in the 19th century who loved, quote, scenography, costume and illuminations. Because why would we need them now? Well, here's the answer. He writes, you know, we have no real expectation of scenic extravagance, apparently. And then in brackets, we have cinema for that. So there was something about this production which was deliberately gendered male. It was sort of meant to be a kind of pared down, driven, edged version of what was a little bit too florid and balletic and a bit too French.
But also, like, he doth protest too much because it was entirely cinematic, the production Indeed. That he made.
And phrases, I'll finish my quoting, but phrases like dramatic music and real seriousness are unironically quoted in this note. So sure. I just sort of sensed that all of this sort of upward, gun-pointing, saluting, you know, gathering of the Brotherhood had an energy that suited some people more than others in the audience.
Okay.
I was not fully there for that.
Well, yeah, and that's right. And, you know, my opinion of that ultimately with one go was like, oh, this is what Victorian opera's audience is like, because they would be used to these players, mm-hmm. right? They would be, you know, classical music people, opera people, they're following the trajectories of these singers and they're commenting on the tenors of their voices years after years, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like that's the granularity that they get out of these productions and follow being fans of these kinds of works. So I immediately took that as that being the culture of the custom that go there. But, you know, who knows? It could just be, as you say, this singular incident.
Well, and it's interesting that it was directed by a woman in that case.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the main performer, the person in the role of William Tell, is a ring-in from Argentina.
Okay.
So there was a star quality there as
Can
well.
I tell you my, like, very embarrassing layperson thing? I couldn't remember the story. I remember, like, there was, like, the apple and the arrow, but I thought William Tell was the boy.
Oh, yeah.
The young boy.
Yes.
For ages.
Okay.
I got it mixed up. I thought it was the young boy had shot it off the dad's head.
Yeah.
So it took me to, like, halfway through for me to be like, oh, the dilf is William Tell.
And Jemmy is going to be the victim.
Jemmy, gender non-binary Jemmy.
Alexandra Flood.
Played by a woman.
Fierce.
This is what I mean. I loved, there was so much quoting and so much fabulousness in this.
The set reminded me of Hobbiton from Lord of the Rings.
My note right here says this is Luc Besson crossed with The Hobbit.
The Hobbit. It's because they kept popping out of that round door in some kind of tuft.
I know, but with, like, Jean-Paul Gaultier, neo-futuristic, yes. Swiss,
and look,
provincial costumes.
You know you've succeeded in an amateurish setting if you get a boo as the villain
oh my God.
In the curtain call.
And then that's exactly my next note. I said Gessler was a great villain. The fist pumps are too long. Like, they never quite landed with the right editing.
Too soon.
And then I've got crowd booed villains.
Stunning.
Panto. And so that's what I really loved about this. Like, it was so mm-hmm. ambitious, mm-hmm. but so, like, local. And everyone there was, you know, you could just feel that they were really rooting for the production, and, you know, it was a very sweet communal atmosphere.
Absolutely. And brilliant that opera has a scene like that around it.
Yeah.
When Opera Australia, the national company, is marketing itself as much more exceptional and perfectionistic and lifestyle oriented and glamorous, right?
Right.
It was a kind of dusty version of that. It was a more punk version of that.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good word for it.
Mm.
So, you know, what this was 3 hours long with an intermission, what was 3.5 hours long? And it didn't feel very long to me. I enjoyed every second of it.
Mm, absolutely.
I loved it. Thank Rossini. You for taking me.
What does one drink at the opera?
Oh, well, remember I tried to get a cup of tea.
Oh, that's right.
I thought I'd be in the exact right place to get some herbal tea, but no.
Nah.
Just some black tea.
People were thundering upstairs to the bar.
Oh, yeah, they were very upset.
Mm.
Couldn't buy alcohol on the ground floor.
It's got to be champers.
Yeah. Yes. Oh,
or
yeah.
Apple-themed. Cider.
Cider. Warm
cider.
Mulled cider.
Cider from the prematurely Good. Exposed apple.
Can we talk about that exploding apple for a second?
It was delicious. It's the one thing that you know about the story.
That was also another punk aspect.
Good
so
point.
They actually had some pretty good practical effects in this show, but one of them was the apple was obviously like on a timer or had some kind of balance widget on it or something that if it fell off or if it over a certain period of time. So the apple, little William Tell, whose name I can't remember, was balancing it on her head, his, quote unquote, and then it fell off, trying to get it stuck up there again. And I mean, this is like the pivotal moment of the show.
The music's swelling, building.
Dad's got the arrow, and then couldn't get the apple on the head, and then it just exploded.
Before the crossbow had fired.
And God love her, she just jumped up and down like, yay, Dad saved me.
Hugs.
Without a wink.
Survived.
And then the orchestra just...
I love it.
Played on.
So gloriously amateur.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Stunning.
What do you want to talk about in intermission?
What have you been listening to? I'm interested in people's podcast recommends.
We haven't talked about... I don't even think we've talked about podcasts
on
the show.
You were on a podcast.
I was on a podcast.
Neighbours.
I was on Neighbours. Go check it out.
Neighbours is awesome. I loved that episode so dearly.
Vaya and Kate are fantastic.
They caught me up. You caught me up. But did you have to go and do your homework? Did you have to go and watch a year's worth of Neighbours?
No. So okay. Neighbours was in our category for the awards, and they won last year.
Yeah.
And, you know, drunk on the night. I'm so introverted, I can barely speak to other people when we're out. And so I just sort of send Phil out to do all these other things. But Vaya came up to us and she was like, when there's a Neighbours person in a play, we should, you know, do a crossover. And I was like, okay, sure. And I'm like, no. I'm like, I'm not going to go and see a play with a Neighbours person. Anyway, cut a long story short, I was seeing Puffs, which is a Harry Potter play for the Green Room Awards. And I've never read anything by Harry Potter. And Vaya was going.
Harry Potter isn't real.
On the same night.
With Millsy in it.
That's right. That was just some happenstance. So in the end, I ended up going on Neighbours. And I only had to watch, like, because Neighbours goes, like, obviously for a week. But they record once a week. And they pretty much focus on just one episode from the week, which is usually the most dramatic.
Okay.
But I ended up watching a whole week's worth of Neighbours. Mm-hmm. And it's like 22-minute episodes. And I hadn't watched Neighbours since I was a teenager. So that was a head fuck and a half.
That's grueling.
It was a head fuck and a half.
Like the evil twins? I couldn't follow
a lot of it. But it was, but listen to the episode because it's
hilarious. I loved it.
No, I'm telling our listeners.
Oh, fine. Of course. Of course. And I just love the idea of you going to a play about Hufflepuffs.
I know. I had no idea what was going on. The whole time. I was like,
I have started listening to the true crime cold case Australian podcast called
Teacher's Pet,
which is very early 80s, very North Shore, got some sort of rugby club mafia intrigue. This is just episode one.
Mm.
So I'll...
Is it North Shore Girls? Do you know what school it is?
Could be. But it's about a PE teacher, rugby player, having a lurid affair with one of his students.
Girl or a boy?
Girl.
Mm.
And his wife is the murder victim.
Oh.
Mm. So it's reopening that case. I don't know much, but people are downloading it a lot all over the world, and it's interesting to kind of ride that wave a bit.
Okay.
And you were telling me about a podcast that is about porn.
That's The Butterfly Effect.
That's good. I've started that one.
That is actually amazing. Mm. That's something that I've been... It's about the rise of Pornhub and how it's destroyed the porn industry, which is a ridiculous thing to say, but it's a very interesting podcast. But I want to talk about they're kind of in tandem. So I'm obsessed with this podcast called How Did This Get Made? And it's... three people who are actors and they watch terrible movies.
Mm-hmm.
And really the premise is it's like they watch movies so bad they're just like, how did this get made? But they're not like terrible unwatchable movies. They're like, you know, terrible hilarious movies.
Okay.
You know, obvious, really obvious plot holes and things have gone really terribly wrong with post-production and all that kind of stuff. So I listen to these episodes and, you know, every now and again I think, that sounds really batshit. I'm going to watch that one. So I've been watching terrible movies, but at the same time, the host, Paul Scheer, now has a new podcast called Unspooled,
mm-hmm.
where he and another co-host are watching the top 100 American Film Institute films of all time.
Wow.
And most of these films I've never seen. So mm-hmm. I'm taking that as an opportunity to kind of watch the film and watch the film and then listen to the podcast.
So, you are such a completist. I love that about you.
I love structure. Yeah. It's just like, this is like, I'm like a little baby duck. Like, they're just sort of feeding it to me.
Definitely.
I don't have to think about this. It's interesting.
So what films have you seen recently for that project?
I think we've talked about it, well, just you and I. So I watched Ben-Hur, which I loved.
Oh my God.
I couldn't believe how much I love that film.
It has Jesus in it.
It's just, and it was so long. Like, it took me four times to watch it.
Yeah.
But I loved it. And I watched, what's the number one movie?
North by Northwest?
No.
Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane, which I found, which was super interesting. Mm-hmm. But like a lot of these films, because they're kind of jumping all around the top 100, it's so interesting to see how much all of these films are referenced. Like, I'll never be able to watch these films just as a person who's watching it for the first time because they're so quoted throughout history.
Yes.
But yeah, so I watched this movie Swing Time. Have you seen that? Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire?
I haven't.
It's got this blackface tap dance sequence in it. It's fucking insane. So there's, it's been really amazing. I've kind of slowed down because we've hit Titanic.
Well, oh, yeah, but okay.
Yeah, so that's what I'm doing in my spare time when I have any. What else are you listening to? Give me one more.
Well, I love the Slate family.
Yes.
The rebranded Waves.
Oh my God.
Enjoying.
Yes.
Enjoying. You know, I am an original cast preferring listener.
I know.
You know, they've dropped in another weekly show with new people. I'll take a while. I'll get there.
I think that that's the Washington, D.C. office.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, but they are younger. It is kind of delineated between, like, sort of the older ladies and the younger ladies. But I think that's fine.
Yeah. So I've been loyal to Slate Culture Gabfest. I'm now enjoying The Waves more and more. I like that it's weekly.
That's actually gobbling up a lot of my time now. Now that I've got that extra hour, other podcasts are sort of dropping off.
Well, I've been, this is newish for me, but I now time myself to make sure I read for 1 hour every day books.
Yes, I know.
Because of this, though. You know, because you can watch 100 movies and listen to a podcast episode about each of them. And, of course, you know, because there's fabulous material being dropped on TV and podcasts weekly, daily. You know, I just sort of have built a little space around reading for myself.
That's really funny. Like, I was making fun of you, but recently because I'm a project manager by trade, I'm like, I'm going to apply project management tools to everything because it's what I do well. So now I've started measuring all my time against all the activities that I do.
And what are you finding?
Well, that I work 60 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm tired all the time.
Key insight.
When I add all the time for the podcasts and seeing shows for the Green Room Awards and school and work.
Work.
Yeah, but it's interesting.
On that note.
Oh, more work.
Disney.
MKA. Used to have a home in North Melbourne, but now I feel like they're kind of sort of taking up theatres all over the place. But much neglected theatre company on this show. I don't know. I honestly can't think of why we haven't covered them before, apart from that for some reason their marketing just doesn't get to me via the socials. So I have to make a concerted effort more and more because they are a really interesting theatre company. And this show will just abbreviate to
the death of Walt Disney.
Yeah, we'll whittle it down. Walt whittle it down. And this is part of the Provocare Festival, which I had also not heard of. A Southside Festival, lots of theatres, lots of, it seemed to be sort of like almost like a dark mofo-y kind of feel of like dark and interesting, intriguing works. So this was another theatre that we'd never been to in Paran. And the little blurb says, aided by a pack of cigarettes, a liter of vodka, his family, and countless dead lemmings, Walt Disney reads you a screenplay he wrote about himself and his death. A public reading of an unproduced screenplay about the death of Walt Disney is about fantasies, corporate monopolies, the price of success, and the Disney dynasty. Walt Disney, his brother Roy, Walt's daughter Diane, and his son-in-law Ron. So what's, you know, particular of note for this show is Walt Disney is played by Tobias Manderson Galvin, and his sister Kereth is playing the brother Roy, Walt Disney's brother Roy, and Walt's daughter Diane is played by Tobias and Kereth's mother, Lenore Manderson. distinguished professor, as it says here in the notes. And the son-in-law, Ron, is played by their dad, Patrick Galvin. So it's a real family affair, literal and metaphorical.
And reversed and flipped.
And reversed and flipped. I didn't really... This is a playwright, Lucas Hnath, from the US. I didn't really do a lot of research about this play. I don't know whether... Like, I'm pretty sure that the conceit is it's that it's just a table read and it's Walt Disney sort of, you know, mouthing off about his life and being able to be the center of attention again. And that unproduced feeling of the play that was really obviously quite overproduced at the same time was interesting. It was a really interesting juxtaposition. I think, like, his parents, God love them, his parents were, like, very seriously prepared.
Yes.
They knew their lines.
Oh, yes.
And it wasn't a table read for them. They knew their lines. They were performing.
Absolutely.
And Tobias, obviously, and Kareth were on, I don't think we went to the same night, did we, Phil?
No, we were there together. Oh,
that was very loose.
Memorable conversations were had.
And Tobias and Kareth were very loose, table ready, kind of loose.
Well, Kareth in particular, you know, yeah, in the role of Roy, she was almost disdainful.
It was almost like they were all in a different play.
Yes.
And so sort of like the direction of that was jarring and it didn't really land for me.
Well, I had the same experience, and I think it's because the script itself was very realistic and reproduced the kinds of conversational rhythms that could actually be staged in a hyper-realistic way with a degree of exaggeration, a few too many repetitions, you know, Walt speaking more than everybody else and nobody succeeding at interrupting him. But when you've got somebody just sort of doing deadpan full stops for all of those interjections, as was happening with this Roy character, it became really difficult to trace in terms of its meaning. You know, the language itself kept stalling, which became part of the meaning of this production, but sure. I'm not sure that it was there in the script.
Yeah,
and I'm not sure that that was the only way that it could have been staged in terms of the speaking roles.
Yeah, and so if it's on purpose, if all of these sort of disparate tempos essentially are on purpose, I didn't really understand what would be the point of that because it really took away from me having a more cohesive understanding of the script, especially, you know, the Walt Disney character was like gunfire, you know, as you would imagine him to be, you know, like very kind of all over the place and, you know, megalomaniacal and narcissistic. The things that I thought worked really well with the show were the costume design and the set design. The costume design was stunning and the set design was amazing. It was like one of those blow-up castles, but it was like a Disney castle.
Yeah, Disneyland.
Sort of, yeah. what did you think about that?
Yeah, I thought that the sort of paper whiteness of that set was appropriate for this sense of seeing something and inscribing something for the first time. The thing that I will remember is the character of Walt Disney, so consistently, scathingly undermined throughout. I mean, he's a monster.
A monster.
It's just actually a really fascinating portrait of a man who is too powerful and given too much freedom to, you know, make things up and do whatever he wants and make claims that are ultimately really outrageous, like the idea that lemmings are suicidal, which was basically invented by him to sell his nature documentaries.
Which I never knew.
Sure. I've just inherited the Lemmings Game version of that. That's how it's come to me, through popular culture. I was also intrigued by the Southside crowd and this festival that we'd never heard of. We must be living in some kind of bubble, like a micro bubble of other theatre companies.
That would not surprise me.
And other parts of Melbourne. We need to break through.
Yes.
I was riding down Chapel Street behind a tuk-tuk, like, you know, vehicle that was taking people to Provocare. I had to pull over the tram lines to get around it. And then you arrive and you realize that the show is literally sponsored by Jack London and everyone is wearing the most gorgeous leather shoes you've ever seen.
I missed that entirely.
You know, this crowd was so well-dressed, so centered.
Yes, they were beautiful.
And talking about Bali, You know, the conversation around us was you know, different tips about getting the authentic Bali experience. And I found it intriguing as a crowd. You know, if we're in our bubble, they're in theirs. There are all of these little micro scenes of theatre going, like the Vic State Opera people who seem to sort of all know each other and the singers. Here, we were in a different kind of space that is authentic but alien. So fascinating.
Loved it. Loved it. I thought this play was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to a few of MKA's performances before, and something that they, you know, you can always guarantee that their design is beautiful and so on point. And yeah, I really like that reading that you have where it's, you know, he basically had license to, you know, completely write his narrative from go to woe. And if he didn't like portions of it, he could just redact it and start again. And then to the point that he can control his own death by writing the script of it post-mortem as
Yeah, I thought there were all sorts of elements that were worth thinking about. The relationship between him and the board of directors of Disney, who were sort of trying to put the brakes on a little bit, you know, just keep building theme parks, Walt. No new directions, no new, you know, no reinvention of the self for you.
Oh, but like how he wanted to create a city.
Yeah.
Like an actual city, you know, suburbs.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's the beginning of a kind of celebrity which now dominates our political and celebrity popular culture. You know, the name as the most valuable thing that a company owns. But what does it mean when that person is still alive?
You know, and a monster.
And a monster. And as they all imagine the unimaginable, which is the death of that person, what does that mean for Disney as a company? So I think all of that was beautifully laid out. And I'm pleased that companies like this are bringing works like this to Australia. Like, it was a really worthwhile script for me to have been exposed to.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I really enjoyed this, and I'm looking forward to covering more shows of theirs on the show in the future.
Provocare next year.
Coming soon.
Coming soon.
I'm on school lockdown, so I'm not doing anything except a million shows for Green Room Awards, but I've got a good coming soon, but you talk first because you're actually going to be out in the world doing things.
Well, I feel that this part of the year needs to be planned and staged.
Okay.
You know, once you're in MIF.
That sounds ominous.
Once you're in MIF, you've got to line up your calendars. You know, you've got to start networking to make sure people are free. I've got my Melbourne Writers Festival tickets.
Okay, what's going on there?
There are some interesting people. I'm going to one little cluster. I mean, it's Marie Cardi's first MWF, so that's always interesting. What I immediately noticed is that she is enjoying curating meetings of minds, you know, clusters of people who we can listen to as a group. There's a kind of democratic feel to many of the offerings. For example, one is called Australia's First President, where we hear speeches that are speculative from first presidents of the Australian Republic.
Wow.
And the list of names is Father Rod Bauer, Marcia Langton, Nakia Louie, Omar Musa, and Matt Preston.
Oh, amazing.
You know, so I'll be at that because why not? Similarly.
She's always had such a boner for Matt Preston. That's hilarious.
J'adore. I will listen to Nakia till the sunset, so that's perfect for
Absolutely.
Me too. And I reckon that's a good strategy for a festival like this. You know, put out a set of names that will draw different people into the same room as each other. She's also got lots of people making so-called toasts, which is dream dinner parties, where somebody's sort of curating a bunch of people to talk about something. Benjamin Law has gathered people to talk about queer history. So Nakuya Gori, Melissa Lukashenko, David Ma, and Nevo Zissen are going to be feasting upon the topic queers across generations with Benjamin feeding them grapes. And then who's that comedian from YouTube who does Gail and the biography of my life, which is I'm Afraid to Talk with Men? That 2 minutes just tells the whole story of my psychology. Chris Fleming.
Okay.
So I'm seeing Chris Fleming live.
I don't know who that is.
Those are my three picks.
Okay, great. That sounds amazing.
Should be good.
I'm very jealous.
That's one weekend. You can join me.
No, I can't. I'm on total ban.
Okay.
But I think we can tell our listeners about our coming soon. So if they want to play along in Melbourne, Our next show is going to be Blackie Blackie Brown, which of course is over, but Dybbuk, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, is going to be at Theatre Works. So that hasn't started yet, so if you want to get along to that. And in September, it's not locked down yet, but we're pretty much going to see Ick Nibbidick.
That's at Malthouse.
At Malthouse. Mm. And Spartacus by the Australian Ballet. I have a coming soon, which is sort of more social, which is obviously like planetary death. So everyone's going zero waste, and it's been my big project this year. And as a part of that, you go down some very bizarre internet wormholes here. But you start you get to the point where you start measuring your garbage. But anyway, so living in an apartment and not having access to a garden, you know, half of your waste is food usually. Like even if I don't waste food, but it's like food scraps, right? So I now contribute to a green waste scheme. Like some guy down the road has 4 million compost bins and I just go and leave them for them. But during this process, I found out that in Korea, the local council in Korea charges you by the pound for the amount of garbage that they have to take away from your house.
Okay.
Right? So this, of course, has driven lots of innovation.
Surprise.
Surprise. So you can buy this contraption. I can't remember what it's called, but it's basically like a garbage dehydrator. It's like it's one that you just have in your house. And so you put all of your food scraps in there and you turn it on overnight. And basically when you wake up in the morning, it's fertilizer. It like takes a whole pound of food scraps and then you're left with like a handful of dust.
Like a wombat poo.
Fertilizer dust at the end. So check that out. They're super expensive.
Do you own one yet?
No, because I've already got this green waste, green share program. Okay. They're like $1,200. I don't have that, but I am very interested in getting one in the future. So Korean garbage disposal, that's my hot tip for saving the planet.
I love Korea.
So that is that for this month's episode of Across the Aisle. We have been beavering away on our social media and online presence. Hit up our website at www.acrossaisle.com or at AcrossAisle for Twitter, Facebook, and now Instagram,
ding, ding, ding,
where we will be posting all of our hot show tips and some amazing Instagram stories from film. Thanks to Ruan from Shack West for making us sound so cogent and fresh. Thanks to Mark Barrage for his musical genius for our theme song. And big thanks again to our subscribers. Without you, we wouldn't have a podcast, seriously. Without financial support, we couldn't pay our hosting bills. So deeply thank you, and see you in a month for our next episode with a special guest.